Well, good morning to you. Good to be here again. As Ian has said, we're continuing on looking at this great Gospel of John in the New Testament part of the Bible. And we're going to read this morning from John chapter 2. So if you have a Bible handy, it'd be great to have that open this morning. And you'll find it on page 1065 of the red pew Bibles that are dotted about. So lean over and grab one of those if you can. 1065 is the page number. I'm going to read second half of this chapter at verse 12. If you're using the church Bible, you'll see the little heading, Jesus Clears the Temple. After this, Jesus went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples. There they stayed for a few days. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found men selling cattle, sheep and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market?" His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Then the Jews demanded of him, "What miraculous sign can you do to show it, to prove your authority to do all this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." The Jews replied, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you are going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many people saw the miraculous signs he was doing and believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all men. He did not need man's testimony about man, for he knew what was in a man. May God bless to us the reading of his precious and inspired words. Last week, at the beginning of John chapter 2, we saw that Jesus began his public ministry by giving a glimpse of his true identity. The water into wine miracle at the start of chapter 2 was not a party trick, but it was a revelation. It was an illustration. It was a glimpse into Jesus' identity that he was nothing less than God himself. By changing water into wine, he was showing in John chapter 2, verse 11, something of his godness. He revealed his glory. That is the glory of God. It was also an illustration of the greater transformations that Jesus had come to make possible. We thought about some of those last week, the transformation that Jesus wants to make of lives that have been cut off from God into lives that know God. The transformation of lives that are weighed down by guilt into lives that are liberated by forgiveness. But the story moves on as we read in our reading this morning. And from Cana, near the Lake of Galilee in northern Israel, where that miracle had taken place, Jesus, we read, heads for Jerusalem. Jerusalem, of course, the capital then, as it is now, of Israel, the center of Jewish faith. And the reason, verse 13, he is heading to Jerusalem, we read, was that it was almost time for the Jewish Passover. Passover, of course, is still kept today. It is the preeminent feast on Jewish calendars. It was the time, and indeed is the time every year, where Jewish people remember their escape from Egypt. 3,500 years ago, the Jewish people had become a slave nation in the land of Egypt. But God, if you know the story, raised up Moses. And with a demonstration of miraculous power, he secured the release of his people from that situation. And the final act of deliverance that God brought about to bring his people out of Egypt was a judgment upon Egypt's sons. It was a night where all the firstborn in Egypt would be put to death. It was a terrible, horrific judgment, but one for which God provided a way to escape. The Israelites were instructed to take a lamb and to sacrifice it and to take the blood of that lamb and to paint it on the doorposts and the lintel of their houses. And wherever that blood was, the judgment of God would pass over that place. It was deliverance through the death of a lamb, a substitute to turn away God's wrath. It was an escape route out of slavery into freedom. And every year since that very first Passover night, during the springtime, Jews remember those events. And at the end of March this year, Jewish families will gather in Glasgow, as they will all over the world, and they will gather together to remember God's greatest act of deliverance on their behalf. But 2,000 years ago, we read in John chapter 1, a cry went up on the banks of the River Jordan, and it said, "Behold the Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world." And in John chapter 2, that Lamb, who John identifies as Jesus, is going up to Jerusalem for the Passover. One of three Passovers that would span Jesus' ministry. But notice how in verse 13, John calls it the Jewish Passover. Because for John now, as he writes this, and for us today, in a place like Greenview, that deliverance from Egypt is no longer God's greatest act of deliverance that we remember. Because Christians have a new Passover lamb. We have a new feast to celebrate. The deliverance that we remember is not from a country, but from sin. Not from political oppression, but from spiritual oppression. Jesus himself is the Christian's Passover lamb. Jesus is the life given in substitute to turn away God's wrath that Christians remember. Remember especially in the springtime. The lamb slain at Passover time, the time that we call Easter. But that's jumping ahead a little bit in John, and we'll come to more of that as we get to Easter here in Greenview. But John, as we will see throughout the book that he has written, is leaving us quite a trail of clues to that place. But for now in our passage, Jesus arrives in Jerusalem, and he goes to the great Jewish temple that was situated there. The temple that was the focal point of Jewish worship. It was the dwelling place of God, the place in which God had promised to dwell in a special, unique way. God, of course, is everywhere. But there in Jerusalem, there was a special presence of God. It was the place where the animal sacrifices were made. Those sacrifices that were made throughout Jewish history, right up until the time that that Jewish temple, that building in Jerusalem, was destroyed around about 70 AD. But every week and every month and every year, decade after decade, century after century, sacrifices were made in that place. It was the holiest place for Jewish people. It was a place to refresh faith. It was a place where they went to meet with God. It was a place where they went to feed their souls on God's greatness and goodness, on his magnificence and his mercy. But as Jesus goes to this temple, this center of the whole earth, spiritually speaking, God's own house, he is not met by reverence, but with a racket in every sense of the words. We saw that, didn't we? Verse 14, in the temple courts, he found men selling cattle, sheep and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. Pilgrims were being treated as punters. Acts of devotion had become revenue streams. The coinage industry was in full swing, because the common coinage of the day would be Roman coins that would often have the emperor's picture on them and perhaps some inscription about the emperor's greatness or almost divinity. They were acceptable to be used as an offering in the temple. So there were plenty of people on hand to change them into the temple coinage and make a good profit in the process. And of course, I think we can assume that the animals that were being sold for these sacrifices were probably not being sold at cost price. If you've ever been to a castle gift shop, you will know something of the markup that you get in those kind of places. The temple, God's house, all that that meant, all that it stood for, its holiness, had become a tourist trap. And as Jesus looked at the abuse of God's house, as he saw this exploitation of God's people, he is indignant and angry. He is compelled within himself to make a stand, to take action. And he makes, we read, a whip out of cords, and he starts cleansing that temple and driving out all the commerce and the money making. Verses 15 and 16. We can only imagine the consternation and the uproar. We're almost taken aback ourselves, I think, about the physicality and the force that Jesus seems to employ in doing this. But notice, though, that it was controlled anger. This was not blind fury. Jesus was not going on some kind of wild rampage. Did you notice that he drives out the livestock, he turns over the money changers' tables, but he orders the removal of the doves? Why is that significant? It's because he's not going about just haphazardly knocking over cages or releasing, letting go the animals. Jesus is acting proportionately. He's acting appropriately. There is nothing rash about his actions here. If ever it needed saying, this is the passage to mention it. Jesus was not a toothless, hand-wringing wimp of a guy. If that's your impression of Jesus, some kind of effeminate hippie walking about, then let this passage put you right. He wasn't a walk on by, keep your head down, ignore it and hope it goes away kind of a man. He cared about stuff. He got involved. He called things what they were. He called sin, sin. And never the more so when he saw the good name of God being abused. When he saw God's house being undermined and brought into disrepute in these kind of ways. In verse 19, John notes that the disciples made a link between Jesus and how he responds to this abuse of God's house and Psalm 69. Psalm 69 is a great, what is sometimes called messianic psalm. That is a psalm that speaks or looks forward to a Messiah. A Messiah being a great deliverer, somebody who we look to sort out problems, to put things right, to come to our aid, to save us in some way. And in Psalm 69, there is a psalm which is written by King David many hundreds of years before the time of Christ, and yet it resonates with the heart and life of Jesus himself. So that we see in that psalm not just the voice of David, but another voice speaking through David. The voice of Jesus in a prophetic way. And in that psalm, you can read it for yourself, we read words like this. For I endure scorn for your sake, and shame covers my face. I am a stranger to my brothers, an alien to my own mother's sons. For zeal for your house consumes me. And the insults of those who insult you fall on me. It's a psalm which speaks of great suffering, of a man who was misunderstood and betrayed and rejected, but a man who is passionate about God, who is consumed with zeal for God's house. Of course, in our culture today, zeal, zealousness are quite unfashionable notions, really. The words smack of extremism, of fanaticism, of being a bit unbalanced. We much prefer and esteem characteristics like moderation and being dispassionate, having neutrality. And certainly we cringe, don't we, when people make a big scene or get over emotional about stuff. But you know, Jesus was zealous. He was passionate. And he was demonstrative in his passion about God. If he saw God or God's people being misused, it bothered him. And he said something about it. And it made him enemies. Made him enemies of those who he often had to take to task and had issues with. It made him enemies of those who just wanted a quiet life and wished he wouldn't make a fuss and just couldn't stand the awkwardness. But as a great man once said, you've got enemies? Good. It means that at some point in your life you stood up for something. And let me suggest today, and we are seeing it more and more in the wider culture and society and church culture and even among evangelicalism, our kind of churches, that if we are passionate about God's name and reputation, if we really do care about the things that we profess to believe, then we are increasingly going to have to stand up and at times actually have to make a scene. And others will cringe and they'll shake their heads and they'll disapprove of our stridency. And much rather we went for the characteristics of neutrality and dispassion rather than zealousness. But we'll be in good company. John chapter 2. Of course, the temple authorities immediately challenged Jesus on these actions. Verse 18. Then the Jews demanded of him, "What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" It's really along the lines of, you better have something good to back this one up, Jesus. As Paul, that most Jewish of all church leaders, said later on in the New Testament part of the Bible, the Jews always seek a sign. And Jesus' answer to them is brilliant, isn't it? Enigmatic. Profound. And as you go through the Gospel of John, time and time again, Jesus stuns you with his brilliance, with his wisdom, with his insight, with his total grasp of what is going on, of where people are coming from, and just what to say in every situation. It's an astonishing mind. The one perfect, uncorrupted, unsullied, clear intellect that you will ever read and hear the words of. Because at the first level in this response, he simply just pushes back the challenge to them, doesn't he? He says, okay, if you want a miracle, tell you what, you destroy the temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. So here's what you need to do. And of course they love that, don't they? It's taken 46 years to build this temple. And it wasn't even finished at that point in history. And you're going to rebuild it in 3 days, Jesus. Verse 20. But actually, little did they know at this point, Jesus is actually making a claim which is far more staggering than just rebuilding the Jerusalem temple. Never mind rebuilding the temple in 3 days, as vast and as complex, as stretching of all human possibility as such a thing would be. I mean, could you rebuild the temple in 3 days today if you employed all the technology and all the industry and all the machinery and all the manpower and all the planning and all the materials under the sun and brought them together? Even then, 3 days? But Jesus is actually claiming something that isn't even something that you could even think about or consider or even think might happen. He is claiming about giving life to a dead corpse that has been buried for 3 days. And we don't even have to think about whether all the industry or technology or manpower or planning or materials that we have today could possibly do that. They can't. You see, Jesus has another temple in mind, a one that is even greater than that great temple in Jerusalem. If you were out on Sunday nights recently when we were looking at Ezekiel, you would have thought with us about the new temple that Ezekiel back in the Old Testament looked forward to, a vast, amazing temple that was far bigger and grander and greater than anything that they had in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. But actually, there is a temple which goes beyond and is greater still than even Ezekiel's great vision of a temple. A place where the greatest and final sacrifice for sin would be made forever, once at the end of the age, never to be repeated. A place where God would be found among his people, and there would never be any question that his presence would depart from it or not be found there. A place where hearts would turn in worship in endless praise. A place that all who seek God would make their pilgrimage to. Verse 21. But the temple he had spoken of was his body. You see, Jesus himself is now God's temple, God's everlasting temple. John, later on, years after he'd written his gospel, as an old man, was given a great vision of God into heaven itself. And as he looked into heaven, that new Jerusalem that would come down from heaven itself, the dwelling place of God's people in eternity to come, he looked into that city and he saw no temple there, because God and the Lamb were in it. Revelation 21 verse 22. No temple there because Jesus is there. Did Jesus have authority to clear the temple? Yes, but not because he could do miracles, but because the temple, in all its grandeur and all its history, was simply a signpost that had been planted by God to point people to Jesus himself. Jesus, who was the temple that God had always had in mind. You see, just as Christians have no need for a Passover anymore, we have no need for a physical, geographic temple anymore. Jesus is the place of our sacrifice for sin. Jesus is the focus of our worship. In Jesus we draw near to God. Jesus is the place to go, not in long wandering pilgrimages here and there to this holy place or that holy place, but in your heart. It's where you meet God in Jesus. As the New Testament later states, for God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, in Jesus. Interestingly, this section finishes with a comment, not on Jesus, but on the people around him at that time. We read that Jesus' refusal to do a miracle for the temple authorities didn't mean no miracles. We know, reading through the Gospels in the New Testament, that Jesus' whole ministry was filled with a succession of healings and signs and wonders. course, those weren't always good enough for some people to have heard about them. Some people will insist always on a personal performance. But for many who saw the miracles, we read verse 23, that they believed. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them. Wouldn't commit himself to them at that time. Just as with Jesus' question of the disciples back in chapter 1 and his response to his mother when she came to him with the problem of the wine in chapter 2, Jesus is all too aware of fickle faith. You know, it's relatively easy to draw a crowd, but for what? You see, this is an important point. In the Gospels, there is a thing, you won't read these words in the Gospels, but it's what theologians call the messianic secret. The messianic secret. You see something of that when Jesus orders somebody who he has healed not to tell anybody about it. Remember those incidents? You see it on occasions when Jesus seems to be getting mass support and then he walks away from it. John chapter 6 is one example. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who has come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. Just at the point where you think, hooray, things are taking off, the messianic bandwagon is starting to roll, here we go, Jesus withdraws. We'll have nothing to do with it. Why the reluctance? Why the secrecy? Why the big secret? But what theologians mean, and don't worry about remembering the jargon, by the messianic secret is very simply this. Until you understand it all, you don't understand it when it comes to Jesus. That doesn't mean you have to understand everything about Jesus, every part of the Gospel of John, for example. But what it means is that until you understand the mission of Jesus, you don't really understand Jesus. And Jesus was very aware of people making that mistake in these other situations. You see, if you think Jesus is just a great teacher, a great leader, a great prophet, a source of power, then you still haven't understood the most important thing about him. You can even believe this morning that Jesus is the Son of God who came down from heaven, but still not understand the gospel, not really understand what this is all about. You've still missed the big point. And as Jesus looks at the crowd at this early part of his ministry, he knows that they still don't know the big thing. He knows, to borrow a phrase, what they don't know. And until they know it, their belief can never be more than just superficial. Something which was graphically demonstrated when the big secret was revealed. And the crowd that welcomed them on Palm Sunday, cheering and singing Hosanna, turned into the baying mob of Good Friday. You see, until you understand that the big thing about Jesus is his death, until you understand that sin is your greatest problem, you don't understand Jesus. Until you understand that the most amazing act of Jesus' life was not turning water into wine or feeding 5,000 people or walking in water, but going to the cross, that his death was his greatest glory, you won't understand Jesus. You won't understand what it means to be a Christian. You won't understand that the greatest thing that Jesus offers you, the thing you need Jesus for more than anything else in your life, is forgiveness. Time is gone. Let's just trace this back as we close. To understand Jesus, you need to understand that he is now God's temple. But that crucially, he is a temple that was destroyed, ruined and desecrated. the temple torn down so that we might be built up. The temple forsaken so that we might be rescued and recovered by God. But it was a temple that God himself would restore and raise up, would rebuild and glorify in his resurrection 3 days after the cross. That Jesus is the temple that we are called today to turn to worship. That he is the place that we need to trust in, the one that we need to trust in, that he has made that final sacrifice once and for all for sin that will keep us safe and secure and forgiven and accepted by God in the eyes of God himself. He is the one that we need to go to pilgrimage to in our hearts every day and meet with God there. Would you not be passionate about that temple? Would you not be zealous to see it honoured and respected, to see its reputation exalted? Would you not want to throw out the trash that is not worthy of it, that sullies it, that brings it into disrepute, that spoils it? Let's be passionate about Jesus, because he was passionate about us. He is our temple. He is everything that we need and look for. Let us understand who Jesus is and put our trust in him and go to him and nowhere else and be passionate about living for him. May God bless to us his words.